Good morning.
My name's David Hockaday. I am from the ECB project, which I'll be telling you about over the next few minutes. I have been involved in the humanitarian sector since about 1994, in various posts in country offices, region offices, and also in a number of headquarters in the UK. I've had deployments to Sudan, Cambodia, India, Bangladesh, and other locations in my time. And I'm here to talk to you about the simulation initiative. Just very quickly, the Emergency Capacity Building Project is a five-year collaboration amongst six of the world's largest international non-governmental organisations. The objective of the project was to improve the speed, quality and effectiveness of emergency response through staff capacity building initiatives. And this is primarily targeted at the national level. So this is all about building national response capacity. And this phase has run between 2008 and 2013. And actually, it's just closing down right now. Capacity building, I've used the term here. What is capacity building? Well, in brief, it's an individual skill or organisation improvement process, such as a self-guided learning process, trainings, workshops, meetings, seminars, coaching or mentoring. Can involve looking at evaluations, after action reviews, joint actions, of course recruiting more staff, that's a way of building capacity, and at the very bottom there, simulations. How do simulations build capacity? Well, they're an excellent opportunity, and this is the fuzzy area I've been hearing this morning. I didn't actually know I was in the fuzzy area until this morning, so I've learned something myself. I've had my capacity built. It's very fuzzy. It's all about building relationships. It's about testing individual competencies. It's about providing a safe learning space for participants to try new behaviours or approaches. This capacity building can lead to organisation or individual improvements. It's basically about providing a safe space for people to succeed and probably most importantly to also fail. Why do we need to build capacity in the humanitarian sector? Well, there is a lot of evidence out there that disasters are increasing in frequency and intensity. The world population is growing and therefore there are more people living in less space. The UN have estimated by 2025, 50% of the world's population will live in disaster-prone locations. Therefore, it's critical that agencies and staff are prepared for an emergency response. And this is particularly about preparing staff, again, working at the national level. This is our area of focus. In terms of simulations in the wider humanitarian sector, we think they're increasingly being recognised by the broader humanitarian community as an essential disaster preparedness tool. We've done some work with other organisations and initiatives, created a case study actually, which is on the PACSIMS website, looking at other organisations and how they use simulations. The Harvard Humanitarian Initiatives, part of Harvard University, use them. The United Nations, various bodies there use them, the World Food Programme use them, and national governments around the world are increasingly using simulations as a tool to predict and model responses to disasters. Tools and guidance also exist on the UN site. It's the Preparedness Tracker website. It's fairly nascent at the moment. It's not very well populated with much data, but it's out there and you can go to it there. There's the link. You do need to sign up to it, unfortunately, but it's a very simple process. For us, we produced a guide, so we codified how you can administer a simulation in phase one. Phase one ran between 2005 and 2007. And this guide basically provides guidance on how to run a single agency. So that's, for example, if I work for Oxfam, the guide provides me the guidance on how to run a simulation from the perspective of Oxfam. And it also provides a second tool, which is about how you run a simulation for multiple agencies. So, for example, if I wanted to get the six agencies of the Emergency Capacity Building Project into a room to test a particular scenario, the guidance in the administrator's guide tells me how to do that. It's actually one of our top 10 downloaded tools from our website over the last 5 years, which is indicative of how interested people have been, I think, in simulations in the humanitarian sector. Over the last 5 years, we've run 17 simulations. We've run those in our pilot countries in Bangladesh, Bolivia, the Horn of Africa, which is composed of, for us at least, Uganda, Somalia, and Kenya, Indonesia, and Niger, and we've involved many international and local NGOs, governments, government ministries, government departments, United Nations agencies, and donors as well. And in that time, we've simulated floods, cyclones, droughts, and conflict. Perhaps the most popular hazards that we've simulated are floods and cyclones, because they provide a very clear starting and not so much clear finishing point, but very clear starting point. Droughts and conflict are probably a little bit harder to simulate from a humanitarian perspective, because there is often not a very clear starting point, particularly for things like droughts, which are longer term, they can develop over the course of many, many months. And we'll talk about a little bit about that later. What does the simulation look like? So generally, this is generally, because they can be quite different. There's 30 to 40 participants held over 2 days, one full day for the simulation, and then we try and do a full day's debriefing the following day. And generally, again, participants are organised into agency teams. So for example, if I'm there representing World Vision, or if I'm there actually from the government of Bangladesh, I will be asked to play the role of the government of Bangladesh in that particular crisis. It adds to the realism of the situation. There are moments, there are simulations where you can actually change things around to enable people to get a perspective of what it's like working in a different role. And that helps with empathy and other fuzzy issues like that in the debrief. You can spread the simulation over many rooms. For example, a room like this might be held for a briefing room where people come in and get basic information at set points during the day. There'll be breakout rooms further down and across the venue, which we can use for different scenarios. We have used, for example, you might use one room which you would call a community room, and that's basically where you'd put role players who would be playing the role of disaster-affected communities, drawn generally from the local and national population to make it more real. Technology can be used. We heard a little bit this morning about fairly tech-intensive simulations. I try and stay a little bit away from those because, again, our focus at the national level is often working with people who don't tend to use email on a day-to-day basis because of where they're based. Connectivity is minimal, technology is minimal. So we try and replicate conditions, what it would be like for somebody working in the delta of the Sundarbans in Bangladesh, for example, in very remote locations. We try and replicate what it might be like for them. And we're not like the military. We can't fly in. We can't afford to fly in thousands of satellite phones and big tech-intensive operations. We tend to work using very basic and rudimentary technology. The objectives of a project, ECV project simulation, you can have any one of these. You can actually use them all, or you can use a combination. You can use simulations to identify skills of individuals. You can use simulations to develop and practice preparedness and contingency plans. Develop and practice organisational preparedness and relationships, and also to build organisational capacity. So quite different levels there. It can go from the individual through to the organisation, or in fact even systemic issues that may be occurring between, say, a government, the United Nations and the NGOs. If there's an issue in that room, then you can use simulations to draw that out. Simulations can build trust and networks. Trust is such an important factor in humanitarian responses. I've done some work, a big case study recently, on how trust is basically one of the single biggest factors that undermines successful collaboration and coordination in humanitarian response. Simulations can also pre-position relationships, and that is as important, maybe if not more so, than pre-positioning things like buckets and resources and well diggers and all this other kind of heavy equipment. It can also help to build staff confidence, like I said at the beginning of the presentation. It helps people to get things wrong in a safe environment. Then you can interrogate how that went wrong and what people can do to improve on their skills and competencies going forward. This photograph here is from the simulation we ran in Kenya in December 2012. It was done in collaboration with many partners, including the WFP, the World Food Programme, United Nations. We had the Crisis Response Centre there, which is the department within the government that's responsible for disasters in Kenya. And it was basically a preparedness simulation in terms of preparing for the election that was held, I think, earlier this year. And it was very, very important because it also brought together and brought into the room people who would be at the regional levels and coordinating regional responses in the event should conflict occur as a result of the election. And it helped people to test out the contingency plans that had been made prior to the elections. A very, very successful initiative, and thankfully the elections passed off relatively peaceful this time. Key features of successful simulations, trained and skilled facilitators, not only to implement the simulation, to make it effective and make it realistic, but also to bring out some really important points during the debrief. And often the people who will implement and make a simulation operation can be quite different to the people who facilitate a debrief, quite different skills needed there to get people in a room to talk to one another, to empathise, to go through a dialogue together. And if it's done very badly, you can actually create and increase tension between partners who are already slightly at loggerheads. So the role of the debrief facilitator can often be as important, if not more so, than the person who implements the simulation. Injects. These are things that you would use, you would introduce the simulation to drive a simulation down a certain path. For example, you may set a scenario that there may be conflict about to break out in Kenya. And then all of a sudden, if you wanted to, if you feel that people are too much in their comfort zone, you can bring an inject in. For example, a massive flood has broken out, causing a massive refugee influx, and then get people out of their comfort zones and talking about a different issue and seeing how they react under stress, under pressure, with a very different scenario unfolding. Again, this has to be managed very, very carefully because you don't want to push people too far out of their comfort zone to the point where they become disengaged. And I've been in a number of simulations where I've seen many people sitting around the outside of the room on their BlackBerries, on their iPhones, and when you ask them what's going on, they'll say, it's too much, I can't cope with this. It's interesting, you should debrief that, but you don't want half the room to be disengaged because then you lose the effect of the simulation. Most importantly, a debriefing session, a full day should be dedicated towards this because it enables people to talk about what happened, to analyse the timeline, to see what went wrong, what went right, and that's how you learn. And then at the end of it, a development of an action plan. So what am I as an individual going to do as a result of having been through this process? How am I going to behave differently? What am I going to take back to my organisation? And what can we do as a group together that's going to improve our situation? And Tom made the point earlier, I was thinking about a simulation we did in Bangladesh where we were working with a consortium there who developed this incredible humanitarian response plan. They were going to work together to deliver humanitarian response. Incredible aspiration and ambition. And we ran that through a simulation. And during the debrief, we all sat and looked at each other and realised that there's no way that consortium could do a joint response together. The simulation had helped us to make that conclusion. And as a result, we just cut it. We got rid of that aspiration from their plan and we decided to focus on a couple of things they did very well during the course of the simulation instead. Totally different to their mission and totally different to their objective, but the simulation had helped us to see that consortium didn't have a niche in a joint response and didn't have a niche doing that kind of things together. They had different niches that they could fulfill. And the simulation helped them to do that. We've run lots of metrics, maybe not as in-depth as yours, Rex, but we've managed to do some metrics on this. We've had some good responses. We had 7 simulations between 2010 and 2012. 91% of respondents said that they were good or useful. 140 evaluation respondents from a separate suite of simulations said that they were very or quite satisfied with the simulations. Probably for me most pleasingly is that 100% of 139 respondents to a different set of simulations said they're a useful way to test or apply learning following a simulation or a learning event. We tend to use simulations at the end of structured learning programs as a way to allow participants to apply the behaviours and knowledge that they have picked up throughout that learning journey. And for in our sector, a lot of the key, the tangibleness from this is all about, well, great, you've been through a learning process over 9 months, but so what? What have you learned? And if we can demonstrate that people are actually applying changes in behaviours, then that's very, very important. And what we'll do to triangulate that is we'll go to the managers of the participants who have taken part, and we'll ask them to demonstrate or provide observations of how they have seen the participants applying that. And a recent survey showed something like 70%, or something, 67% of managers have been able to see a demonstrable change in the participants' behaviour as a result of being through one of these processes. It's not quite 100%, but it's a tangible that we can talk to. And we're talking to donors about where they should be funding. Simulations are particularly powerful. A couple of lessons from successful simulations. Choosing the right simulation for the context is so important here. It's no coincidence that when we run the simulations in Bangladesh, the most popular choice of hazard profile has been cyclones. It's no coincidence at all. So realism really helps, and it helps for people to get into their roles, it helps for people to draw on their past experience, and also helps with precedent as well. We tend to try and, as much as possible, create the simulation based on the actual country. So using data and information, for example, when we ran in Bangladesh, we actually used the name of the next storm or cyclone that was going to be that was actually going to be used for the next storm or cyclone using a website. But there are also situations, I think in your example, you create a country, by Narnia or whatever it was. We've done that before as well. There are different pros and cons for each approach. Personally, I prefer using a real context, but equally I understand if you create a country, a fictional country, then you have more control over the stimulus and injects that you use. Getting the right people in the room is so important. There's no point in creating an organisational contingency plan as a result of a simulation if you don't have decision makers in the room at that point. The plan will never get mainstreamed, it will never get buy-in. And equally, there's no point in having people in the room who wouldn't be part of a disaster response, because that's a waste of everybody's time. Thirdly, good planning improves the simulation, that's pretty obvious. And then last point here, related to the attendance of the right people, is about getting management commitment and appropriate support. You can't run a simulation on a shoestring, although we have tried in the humanitarian sector. And therefore, you need to put money to this particular task. It may sound obvious, but it's worth mentioning. A couple of conclusions. From our perspective, simulations are an excellent tool. This is in the humanitarian sector. Simulations are an excellent tool to develop the fuzzy stuff. That's the staff skills and capacity, procedures and contingency plan. You can test those sort of things. Building relationships and trust. So I talked about it earlier, the prepositioning of relationships. And then lastly, bringing a greater degree of predictability into humanitarian planning and response. For more information, our website, ucbproject.org/simulations. There's a couple of case studies up there. The guides, which I spoke about earlier, and some articles. That's all. Thank you very much.